Connector.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It all started with an infected left thumb. A young sailor by the name of Alexander Shulgin was serving in the U.S. Navy in the North Pacific when a doctor gave him morphine for the pain in his thumb. Shulgin says he was fascinated at the manner in which his mind disconnected from that throbbing thumb. Well, it all led to a chemistry degree at UC Berkeley, a stint at Dow Chemicals, but more important, a lifelong search for the precise chemical or botanical compounds that open those closed passages into the brain, into the self. Along the way, Alexander, or as he prefers to be known, Sasha Shulgin, revived MDMA, or ecstasy. Also along the way, his many explorations have included testing the compounds by himself, on himself, or with his wife Anne, sometimes with a select group of friends. It is an approach to psychoactive drugs or phenethylamines or tryptamines that is not shared by the establishment. The establishment says drugs are bad. Connection listeners, does government policy, does the war on drugs close too many doors on research, on Shulgin's explorations? How could you ever define a responsible, sensible approach to drugs and psychological exploration? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from a studio in Berkeley, California, are Sasha and Anne Shulgin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Hello.
So, Sasha, what's the latest? Yes. What's in the lab right now? What are you working on?
Right now I'm involved in some very interesting compounds known as tryptamines. It's an outgrowth of having been involved in the whole area of plants that has been very little explored, which are the cacti. There are a number of cactus that have been used in both religious services and in personal exploration and in medicine that have never been explored chemically, and no one really has looked at what's in them and why they are active, and that I find to be totally fascinating.
So what do? You take them apart, you figure out what they're made of, made from, you test, you then will try and ingest some of it. How does that work?
Well, you take a cactus, and the first problem is to get the same cactus twice, because so many people disagree as to which cactus is what. So I usually keep a botanical specimen in my greenhouse that I know is the same plant. Then take the plant and from it make a mush, and the mush then is extracted with an organic solvent. That then is analyzed by a variety of tools, either gas chromatograph or liquid chromatography, mass spectroscopy. This gives you a picture of what's in there. Then you look at the various components and determine what they are, and as best you can, synthesize those that might be of interest, and having gotten those samples in hand, find out if they're active and can contribute and explain the activity of the cactus itself.
Now, the finding out part is ingesting the compound yourself, right?
There's no other way of finding out if a compound is psychoactive.
I'd like to add, though, that Sasha always starts at a very, very small, tiny, weeny little dosage level so that he can be pretty sure that there is nothing on the way that is going to be surprising, because he goes up very slowly and very carefully over quite a period of time.
And as you increase the dosage, how do you know where to stop? How do you know what it is you're looking for?
Well, actually, the truth, if I knew what I was looking for, I wouldn't be doing the experiment. The part of it is to find out what it is in the material, in the cactus in this case, and the compound itself. What does a compound do to the mind? Because the people who have used the cactus and use it in their ceremonial services or in their medical practice know what the cactus does, but they do not have the tools to find out why and what it is in the cactus that does it. So by taking the cactus apart, you would get to the compound or compounds that cause the virtues or cause the unusual aspects of the cactus intoxication. And from that, one can then publish that information, and who knows what comes from it, new medicines, new understanding, new research tools.
And you take the compounds as well, is that right?
Yes, he usually takes a new compound at a very, very low level, and he works it up until he begins to get some effects. And at that point, he'll bring me into it, and I will take it with him from there on until we find what we consider the maximum desirable dose, and then probably back down a little bit. This can take weeks or even months.
Just to use the sort of language that we understand about it, we're talking about some kind of tripping, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tripping is a sort of a jazzy word at the moment, but things that affect the mind that make it faster, make it slower, that make it more understandable, tend to bring things out into the open that is tucked away in the unconscious. This I consider to be a potential very valuable tool for understanding how the mind works.
And there's another aspect of it. Sasha is the scientist, but to me, and I think this goes back at least 50,000 years, these visionary plants and drugs of this kind have been used for spiritual purposes for most people in the world. And this means, however you define spiritual, it means that you're seeing a connection between yourself and the world around you and the world within you and the cosmos. All this is difficult to put into words because we don't really have a good vocabulary.
And at one level of the testing, you'll also invite friends in, is that right?
Well, what we like to do is once we have established the nature of the action and that it is worth pursuing, we have a research group, we at least had a research group, who would then meet and we would be able to get a picture of a variety of responses over different people. Sometimes people are quite sensitive, sometimes they're relatively insensitive. This would give us a range of activity that then would be an assignable property of the compound. Then with that, we can publish.
Now, you've taken a lot of these compounds over the years. Does that make your brain different from my brain?
My heavens, how do you tell? Maybe we could find a tool that could establish the letters and identification of a person's brain. Everyone is different. And I can't tell you if we have, I suspect we have different brains, we're in different places. But I can't tell you how they're different, in what way they are, which is more the imaginative, which is the more more steadfast, which is perhaps the more intelligent. There's no way of telling that I know of. All we're doing is trying to find tools that might give us numbers and might give us ways of establishing these differences.
But if it's so subjective that the effect of a compound on Anne's brain or your brain or my brain or someone in the research group brain would be so different, how do you draw a conclusion that you can call scientific?
Scientific is a word stemming from the observation. You see what is done. You see what happens. You are, by definition, have a subjective response. You take a drug and you tell what happens. This is why animals are absolutely worthless in this type of research, because there's no communication with animals. You can't tell if the animal has insight or has fear of his birth memory or perhaps fear of dying. This is not to be gotten. The whole study, for example, that can be done in animals are that you hurt the animal, then you find a drug that keeps the animal from responding to the pain. Or you have an animal that is too wide awake, you give a drug and find the animal sleeps more. These are objective things that could be measured by animal studies. But the subjective aspects of the human response, you take a compound and you suddenly realize that when you were 3 years old, you did have a rather interesting experience one time under the tree in the backyard and no one else knew about it. These recollections of past memories or the understanding of your behavior patterns are totally subjective, and it's almost a fraud to try to be objective in measuring your thought process.
On the other hand, if you're keeping good notes, which our research group had to do, that was one of the requirements, you can, all of you, come together and see how many of you felt this way and how many of you did not feel that way. So there is possible to to make a rather good picture of the activity of a drug, especially when it's something like 10 or 12 people, all of whom are rather different.
Now, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you're very careful, precise about publishing the details of each experiment, and yet the other part of the scientific community doesn't peer review this, tends to look at the work that you're doing as pretty much on the fringe. What's the gap there?
Well, the fringe, I think, has been defined as the unknown. And yes, we're at the edge of the unknown. Not that we're working in areas that are not knowable. We're working in areas that have not been explored. Part of the reason is exactly what you mentioned, where the peer review says this is not appropriate work. And I think this is an extraordinarily selfish way of avoiding the query into who you are and why you are what you are.
Not appropriate because you're testing on people? Is that all that distinguished? Is that the only the difference we're talking about here?
I think to a large measure that is the difference. If you had experimental animals that could answer these questions, I would say bravo. But I remember one time I was giving a lecture somewhere, and the people thought it was about the chemistry of the brain, and what I was talking about was the chemistry of the mind. And that was very offensive to many people there, because animals, you can do brain experiments, but you can only do mind experiments in humans.
And where do you fit with the law? Is what you do legal?
Completely.
Absolutely.
And what makes it legal? For example, if my teenage daughter were caught with an ecstasy pill in her pocket, she'd be arrested.
She'd be arrested because she's committing a felony. She is possessing a drug that has been made illegal. But this speaks nothing about the potential of that drug in medicine. It speaks nothing about the value that can be gotten from understanding the human system by studying that drug.
Well also, Sasha does not work with scheduled drugs. I mean, when he's going into a cactus that's been mm-hmm. used as part of the religious observance of an Indian tribe in Mexico, he is not dealing with anything that has been scheduled, thank God.
Scheduled is a way that the DEA uses to refer to drugs that are illegal, just to be clear. Is that right, Anne?
Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And who are the psychonauts?
Oh, I think that's a term that has been used by journalists. We don't use that term ourselves. I think it's sort of a play on astronaut. Where the people who we and several hundred thousand, if not millions of other people, go exploring inside our own psyches and thereby try to find out a little more about the general human psyche. And that makes us explorers in a sense. And I suppose what we are.
Well, and in a way, leaders of people who revere the work that you do and watch it very closely, Sasha.
That's true. And in a sense, it's a form of payback and flattery to know that the people have found enough value, not only in the popular community, but in the research community, to pursue these things further. If I hear periodically, I read in the journal where they have taken some material that I have evolved and published on and made it radioactive and put it into PET scanning research, or have made it found it to be an agonist for a serotonin receptor and have put it into their research as a prime probe for this aspect of brain chemistry.
Let me just interrupt and say that we have to step away for a break. We'll be back. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. And we're talking about flattery. We're talking about people who are critical of this. We'd be interested in your point of view. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Guests on my program are Sasha and Anne Shulgun. They're chemical explorers, botanical explorers, co-authors of the books Pikal and Tikal, which are compendiums, if I have that right, of the research and the work that you've done over the years. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Actually, the names Pikal and Tikal have come from the two classes of compounds you mentioned very early in the interview about phenethylamines and tryptamines. almost all of the research chemicals that can modify and change and make evident some aspects of the metal process are phenethylamines or tryptamines. And the two book titles are Phenethylamines I Have Known and Loved and Tryptamines I Have Known and Loved.
1-800-423-8255. We're going first to Charlton, Massachusetts, and Mike's on the line. Mike.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Nice to hear. And how are you doing, Dr. Shulgin?
Very fine, Dick.
Back in 1969, 1970, I worked for a woman named Mildred, who was one of your researchers in San Francisco at the university. And she was doing experiments on the effects of LSD-related compounds on rat uteruses. And during that time, we learned that, well, the funding seemed to come through the Navy, and years later she told me it came from NASA. Of course, since then we've had Watergate and so forth and exposures about MK-Ultra. Now, my question is, was that research actually being funded covertly by the government and for what purpose? And my second question is, during your stint at Dow Chemical, it's well known that you invented what later became known as STP. It was actually DOM, which was somehow wound up on the streets of San Francisco at the so-called love-ins, and it actually seemed to be part of that same MK Ultra project. If you have any comments on that, I think the work you do is very important, and it's too bad it can't be done more openly. But I was just wondering about that government funding aspect of it, and whether that still continues.
Well, the two points that you brought up, one is about the government funding of the research of the MK-Ultra and the aspects of LSD research that is much broader than that. It went into marijuana component extract studies, things that eventually were tied in with nerve gas studies, but their action on man. Yes, this is all government-funded, very intensely curious research. The government put out many grants to universities to compare compounds in animal studies just to determine their potential human safety in these areas. This work went on. No, it's been exposed, the work having been gone on in the 1960s. But the word goes on today, but it is now still under the wraps of secrecy. As far as the second point you mentioned about my work at Dow and the STP, this was a compound I developed when I was at Dow. I knew it as DOM, and it's a very potent psychedelic. It has been studied quite a bit because its very close relatives, again, are very intensely interesting serotonin agonists in the neurotransmitting field. This work came out, again, in the 1960s. When I was in San Francisco, I heard of the STP on the street. I had no idea what the drug was, but I later found out it was a compound I had synthesized some 10 years earlier under the name of DOM.
But in fairness to the people who do criticize your work, the makeup of a compound is published in one of your books, and the people who will take you on from an anti-drug perspective say, well, gee, Dr. Shulgin, you shouldn't be publishing the makeup of, you know, ecstasy or STP or DOM or whatever without accepting some responsibility of the fact that it's going to end up on the street.
Well, the argument of publishing has to be looked at from the point of view of making information available. You'll find a very dedicated cry by the authorities that we must have facts known about these materials, and yet they themselves are the source of very often misleading and often out-and-out dishonest information and calling it fact. I'm a firm believer in making all facts known, good and bad, and this is why I'm a firm believer in publishing in the open scientific literature, and anyone who is curious about this can find information in the literature, in peer-reviewed journals, that shows the goods and the bads of these compounds. When you take the issue about their being encouraged for street use, this is not something I do, any more than a person who writes music encourages people conducting things at raves. These are correlates that lie outside of the intent of the original invention.
One of the things to keep in mind is that if Sasha were not publishing, if we weren't publishing these so-called recipes in both books, this doesn't mean that there wouldn't still be thousands of chemists and would-be chemists all over the world doing their best to make substances. And the trouble is, if they don't know what they're doing, they can come up with some very dangerous and even lethal mixtures. So we publish this information so that whoever is going to try to make these things in different countries where there are different laws, by the way, will have the best possible information. Otherwise, if this isn't given out in this way, then the only people who are going to know what these drugs are and how to use them will be the secret parts of the government.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Mike, thanks for your call to Cambridge now. Hope is on the line. Hi, Hope.
Yes, I wanted to say that I was shocked that they're talking as if inventing ecstasy was an achievement, because my grandson had started on ecstasy and has still having drug problems up to this day, which was about 8 years of serious, terrible loss of his youth. And
shall we answer that?
Please.
Well, the first problem is what is ecstasy? We don't use that term because these days, according to an organization known as DanceSafe, who do testing at raves, about a third of the ecstasy tablets actually contain genuine MDMA. And the rest can be anything at all. The term ecstasy does not mean MDMA anymore. It means whatever some enterprising and perhaps criminal person has decided to put in it. And by the way, Sasha did not invent MDMA.
What?
Dr. Shulgin actually took the recipe for MDMA from Merck, which had, I think, come up with it back in the early 1900s.
Before World War I.
Before World War I. But I wonder, though, Sasha, if you can speak to the sense of Hope's question, that if there are kids on the street who are having a bad time with a drug that may be something that you helped explain how to make or discovered, and someone has abused it. Is there a part of you that says, gee, maybe I should have some responsibility for the abuse of the drug as well as the functional use of the drug?
This is a very delicate point. I'm always hurt very deeply when I hear of people who have used materials and have had bad experiences. They are not frequent, but they are real. And from the point of view of a person who is the father of a child who's gone through this and sees it only through the window of his one child who has been hurt and has been apparently badly hurt, I'm extremely saddened to hear this sort of thing. These are the prices that I feel have to be paid for getting materials into the general scientific community to find out what they do. And from these tragic things, maybe there is something to be learned. This, I sincerely hope that these avenues are pursued by the physicians, by the research people who are there at hand to help these victims of either high sensitivity to the action of a drug or to a drug that's not known as to its identity. But I read many of the reports that do come in the medical literature refer to things such as ecstasy or club drugs or materials that have been said to be. And so often there is no verification, although the tools are there in the hospitals, no verification of the identity of the drug or the quantity of the drug that was taken. So much of this is plays on the edge of hysteria and carrying a message of its own that I think does a disservice to the potential of these materials in the medical community.
All right, thanks to... go ahead, Ann.
You have to ask yourself, if all these drugs were not illegal, wouldn't it be possible to have quality control? So that if you bought something called ecstasy, you would know what it was exactly. At this point, the fact that these drugs have been made illegal puts them right out there where anybody can fool around with them. There's no quality control at all. And tragedies can happen. So that's something to think about.
Okay. Hope, thanks for your call, and I hope your grandson is doing all right. Appreciate your sentiment. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Jamesville, Wisconsin, Chuck's on the line. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I've got a two-part thing, and I'll start out by saying that when I was a teenager, I had taken ecstasy or whatever it was that was in it, and my experience with it was, wow, this is the best thing I've ever done. I'm never, ever going to do it again. And the reason I thought that, even as a young teenager experimenting, was that this feels so great. This feels like the pure feeling of love. But I knew that it wasn't real. It was triggering on sensors that allow you to feel that love that does stem from another source. And because it is artificial, like, you know, and see, what it taught me is that I would want to be able to find that feeling on my own, you know, but many people cannot feel that way. And I don't think that this is a drug that should be used to make people feel happy, but I could see how it could be used in an exploration in psychology to figure out what makes us happy, what is the nature of feeling happy. And I think that this might clue into things on that. Also, I'm wondering what your opponents, what they hit on as points that they are not liking about this research, and if they're in the psychiatric field and what their motives might be. And I'd also like to hear a little bit about the MDA or MDMA advertisement saying that if a child dies and the only drug in their body was MDA, and if that is propaganda or what the situation is with the ability to overdose on a pure form of MDMA.
Chuck, let me ask Sasha and Ann to speak to the middle part of your question, because it speaks to the science and the criticism that exists within the scientific community. Because Sasha, as you were saying a little earlier in the program, there is that flattery you get from the people who are watching very carefully on internet websites and exchanging views and ideas about your research at one end. But at the other end, there are researchers who say, this is nuts.
Well, there's a point that has to be borne in mind. It's a phrase, qui bono, to whose benefit. And a great deal of the financing, great deal of the source of funds, the source of motivation for research comes from agencies such as the NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse, various government institutions who are dedicated to discouraging the use of drugs and, in essence, bringing the drug war to some sort of successful conclusion, whatever that might be. And so you'll find that people who do the research and find the effects of drugs on the nerve system, on the serotonin system, on the axons of the brain, will say thank you very much to the government for having made this research possible. And their dedication is to get this grant money, which very often is dictated by having negative results. So you read the reviews of the grants submitted for funding, and you'll find there is not is there damage from this drug, but why is there damage from this drug? In essence, the answer is intrinsic in the way the question is asked.
Let's bring Barry Kosofsky into the conversation. Dr. Kosofsky is an associate neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. And doctor, if I'm right, you're looking at the effect of drugs, not unlike the ones that we've been discussing on the program, the effect of them on young brains, and you're doing the research in the sort of more traditional, accepted way, using other mammals, rats and monkeys. Is that right?
That is correct. I share with Sasha and Ian the identity of a psychonaut, exploring the effects of drug action on the developing brain. And I do that both clinically in a clinic at Mass General Hospital, where I treat drug and alcohol exposed children who are exposed in the womb for developmental and neurologic problems as a consequence of that, as well as a research program based at Mass General Hospital, where I inject pregnant mice with cocaine and look at alterations in gene expression and behavior. That's a NIDA-funded study. So I'm on the same page in terms of, I want to know what these drugs do to the developing brain and how they impact behavior, but I also do it not as the astronaut. I'm not in the capsule. But I am the psychonaut. I am trying to look at the human experiment, the natural experiment, and try to adduce causality. What do these drugs do to the brain? And in the animal setting, I'm directly injecting the drug, so I'm trying to pursue the scientific method to get at an answer of how brain function is altered as a consequence of drug exposure.
And if we're talking, as Sasha was earlier, about the difference between the brain and the mind, how hamstrung are you in your research by the fact that you can't ask the rat or the monkey what the effect of a testing drug is?
So I'll answer that at a couple of levels, if I could, because they directly fall out from the very interesting conversation that you've had to date. One, I disagree that animals are worthless. Two, I feel the brain and the mind are the same. That is, we can look at it from different perspectives, but as a neurobiologist and a clinician, I think that they're indistinguishable. Three, while you can study feelings in animals, you certainly can study emotions in animals. And while I might not be able to understand anxiety in a mouse or rat, I can certainly study fear. Fourth, I want to talk about the difference between use, abuse, and dependence, as Chuck had mentioned, your previous speaker. That is, using drugs once is very different than using them recurrently. And in the vulnerable individual, we know there is the liability, as Sasha pointed to, of moving from use to abuse dependence, as the other caller's grandson apparently did. And the final point for me, then, is the developmental consequence. What if the mother is pregnant? And what does it do to the developing brain, which is very different, perhaps, than what it does to the adult? But the key point we're focusing on is the clinical research and the clinical method. And I understand the need for such what you called fringe research, but I don't think that you can't design these experiments in humans. We need to pursue alternative medicines and alternative approaches, but we need to do it by pursuing a scientific method and clinical design, as well as scientific rigor that allows us to not just publish anecdotes about individuals or groups of individuals, but to prospectively try in animals and humans and understand the effect of these drugs on the brain.
Sasha Nan, just stand by. We have to take a short break. I want to come back, and Dr. Kosofsky, if you can stick around, take this understanding of the different approaches to clinical research a little bit further in an attempt to understand what the two different perspectives are. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we invite you in on our conversation this hour. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Medical students in the first or the second year are told one thing. If it's in the lab, don't eat it. Two of my guests this hour are Sasha and Ann Shulgin, and they do test on themselves the compounds that Sasha works on in his lab as part of an exploration into the effects of psychoactive drugs. Just before we went away for the break, Dr. Barry Kosofsky raised a number of his concerns from the perspective of someone who's working within the system. And I want to pass it over to Sasha and Anne, but just before I do, Barry, haven't you ever wanted to just say, well, I should try this and get a sense myself what it feels like?
I think that's a complex question. Do I have that drive? Absolutely. Anybody who's interested in psychoactive substances has had some experience with alcohol and perhaps other mind-altering substances, and it's fascinating from an individual's perspective, but that's not science, and I can't dictate clinical practice and make clinical decisions based on my personal experience or anecdotes from one or a limited number of people.
Dr. Shulgin.
An interesting extension on that: for a short period of time, at the Langley Porter Institute in San Francisco, where I'm associated with the medical school, this is back in the 1950s, as I remember, it was mandatory that people who were going into psychiatry would take LSD. because at the time LSD as a psychedelic was known as a psychotomimetic, something that imitated the symptoms of psychosis. It was felt that no psychiatrist could in fairness, face a patient who might be psychotic without having some insight of what the patient was seeing through his own eyes. This was discontinued for reasons that are both political and medically sound. But for the period of time, that was indeed part of the preparation in psychiatry.
And there are still people in Boston who espouse that kind of approach to psychiatry, although they are a fringe group.
I believe that.
Let's go back to the word science, though, because Dr. Kosofsky says, I don't take the drugs and write about them because that's not science. A few moments earlier, Sasha, you were saying that precisely is your view of what science is.
I think there's a tendency here to mix up and confuse what is a scientific inquiry and what is a clinical inquiry. The scientific inquiry is to find facts. They may be good, they may be bad, they may be useful, they may be useless. But it's picking up a stone and seeing what's underneath that stone and learning, perhaps, at least observing, what has been crawling around that you have not seen until then. The whole direction of the clinical study is to find ways of helping people or repairing things. I see this quite closely in San Francisco, where I'm involved with some human research on one of the most dangerous and most destructive drugs that's known, which is nicotine and tobacco. The work there is done with human studies, and of course the precautions are made that there is no damage as far as can be controlled that comes from the research. But again, it's a very direct study in human studies, in clinical studies, with a medical overview of what I call scientific research. The two do commingle.
And I would argue that although the goals, the freedom that one has in pursuing scientific versus clinical inquiry, preclinical is what I call it, animal, is very different given the constraints of animals studies versus the protection of human subjects, which is all important, that the approach is identical, which is hypothesis-driven, evidence-based, observer-independent of bias.
I completely agree with you. There's one little touch that cannot be done, and that is the results of human studies of the subjective nature are inescapable when you're dealing with something that deals with the unconscious or deals, let's say, with the concept. Let's take the concept of insight. How does a person relate the potential creation, the understanding, the mechanism of insight research by looking at a rat?
So I agree with you that feelings are something that cannot be studied in an animal, but we are studying it in humans in the building I'm calling from at Mass General East. My colleague Hans Breider puts drug addicts in the scanner and asks them subjectively, how do you feel? Are you high? Are you euphoric? Are you low? Are you crashing? And in association with that is doing functional brain imaging studies to look at the pattern of brain activation associated with drug infusion versus saltwater infusion. So I agree with you that we have to frame the question in animals, and there are certain things that can only be addressed in humans, but it could be studied in humans, even in small numbers, with a controlled, hypothesis-driven fashion that's unbiased and allows for an independent answer regarding whether there is a causality that we try to establish in science.
But let me go back to something that Chuck said a little earlier in the program. When he first tried ecstasy, his response was, wow, this is cool, this is fun. And Sasha and Anne, in a lengthy profile written about you folks in Wired magazine, you're quite straight up about saying in response to the question at that point that there is a certain amount of fun and excitement in the sort of exploration that you're doing. Fair enough?
Oh, sometimes, yes. You also risk, however, discovering yourself in what I call a sorrow place or various places in the psyche that you have to learn your way out of. The exploration of the psyche is more a spiritual experience, as far as I'm concerned, than a scientific one. But I think it is one of the most important explorations a human can do.
But if it is fun, if it is,
it can be.
You know, the sort of thing that you would look forward to a way of spending an afternoon. Mm-hmm. Are you open to what Dr. Kosofsky is talking about when he talks about bias?
Yes, we're biased.
Yeah.
I mean, we make no pretense of objectivity in our research. We have to communicate with one. If you were to take a group of like the work you're mentioning at the hospital in clinical research, do you tell the people who are going into the PET scanner to see where this particular radioactive compound goes what the compound does? What are the things you have to worry about? What must you watch for? You are, in essence, destroying the objectivity of the study by the very running of the study in humans, in which you, by good practice, must
we
tell
worried
them
about
what
the same
risks
thing.
Are.
We worried about that identical thing when we designed the studies 8 years ago and got them approved by our institutional review board. But because of the way human studies are done, we can only give the drug to those people who are already addicted. And that's a limitation. You cannot get the initial sensation from a drug-naive individual because it's not sanctionable. However, the addicts that get the drug in the scanner report the same kind of euphoria that they do on the street. Now, whether they're telling us the truth or not, all we can do is report what they're telling us. And what's interesting is we can create craving for the drug by showing them the cues that are normally associated with the drug. And they say they can feel it, they can taste it, and give us this objective report. So I agree with you, it's not a natural setting, but we were amazed to see that in a it's an fMRI study, so in a magnet that's banging away, that these addicts are still getting the kind of euphoria that they say they get on the street when they're injecting drugs in their home turf.
Barry, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Barry Kosofsky is an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. He's also associate neurologist at Mass General Hospital. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Florence, South Carolina now, and John's been waiting on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, Dick. Enjoying the show here. I went to a university where in our fraternity we had aspiring doctors and chemists who were synthesizing MDA, not MDMA, and DET, which was called diethyltryptamine, in the lab. Mm-hmm. And for the MDA, they weighed doses out on a Mettler balance because I guess you could take a lethal dose of it. A lot of the kids were taking this. Once I tried the MDA, and I enjoyed it. Another time, I had a date put a dose in my drink without knowing it, and I was really upset about that. And then another time, I had a joint that was laced with diethyltryptamine, and I could actually feel it diffusing into my bloodstream from my lungs, and I was instantly in a hallucinatory state. And I was just curious if, Sasha has had any experiences with these or knows anything about these drugs, MDA and diethyltryptamine, or DET.
Yes, they're both very interesting, both very active psychedelic compounds. Interestingly, both were developed by industry for medical application. MDA was established originally, I forget the name of the company, in the 1960s as a possible dieting agent or restricting the need for food. And then when the psychedelic aspects of it became evident in human studies, it was dropped. DET was, I believe, originally established through Sandoz in their studies of the 4-hydroxy-DET as analogs of psilocybin, or the magic mushroom component. Both are active. Both are now technically illegal, but they were both were developed in the search for medicines and things for understanding the function of the human body, human mind.
Am I correct in remembering that at a certain point, wasn't it the CIA who did an absolutely reprehensible, dreadful thing to a mental patient and overdosed him with MDA, caused his death?
Yes, so they gave about 700 milligrams in an intravenous injection, and the person was dead about a day later.
John,
and it was done. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank John for his call and ask you in a bigger picture, Sasha. You've been searching for decades for ways into the subconscious, ways into the places of the mind that you say you can't get to without drugs. And as I read about that and thought about it, I wondered if there's one thing you're looking for, if there will ever come a time where you say, that's it. That's what I wanted. That's what I was looking for.
I'd like to say that's so, but the truth of the matter is the further I delve into this mysterious area, the more I realize how ignorant I am. And so the search goes on with more vigor. But I don't think it's ever going to be brought to a conclusion.
That's like asking a composer why he keeps composing new music. Hasn't he found the perfect music yet? No, the universe presents you possibilities that are endless. And music is I think, a pretty good way to compare it.
Does that make you artists instead of scientists?
I think the whole art of science is an art. And when I teach at the University of California, I teach chemistry as being an art form and not a science. It's quite a disturbing thing to some students.
You're also a little bit of the mad scientist, aren't you? I mean,
No, he isn't.
Oh, now, come on, Anne.
I should know. I've been married to him for over 20 years. He's a very, very sane and very sensible person.
I guess I don't mean mad in the crazy sense as someone who has set his mind on a way of doing a certain amount of study, which, regardless of what the establishment might have to think about it, you're just going to keep on doing it no matter what anybody says.
One has to sometimes change one's vocabulary to mollify the authorities, and this I'm very happy to do. For example, one could not study new psychedelics, but one can study new antidepressants. And so one finds often little ways of conducting one's work that takes away a direct vulnerability.
I'd like to say very briefly that when you talk about fringe studies, remember that not very long ago, a fringe included things like hypnosis, anything to do with the environment, and psychiatry itself. They were all considered fringe studies or fringe science not too long ago.
There wasn't quite as much establishment muscle saying that all that stuff was illegal at the time.
We did not have laws that made them illegal.
That's right.
But the laws are there now, laws that say, oh, you shouldn't be touching this, you shouldn't be taking that, you shouldn't be doing things the way that you're doing them.
And they should be repealed.
They should look again at some of the aspects of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution that say you do not dictate people's behavior.
Mm-hmm. I really believe that no government has the right to tell an adult citizen what he can do with his body or his mind. I think that's a basic right that all of us have as adults to do and sometimes to make mistakes with our bodies and minds. But it is our business.
Our prerogative.
This time yesterday, someone was making the same point about Lenny Bruce's work. It seemed we end up there more than I might have expected. Sasha and Anne, thanks so much for coming in.
And thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Sasha and Anne Shulgin, chemical explorers, co-authors of the books Pikal and Tikal. Earlier we talked with Dr. Barry Kosofsky, child neurologist at Mass General Hospital and a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. We had help today from Ethan Brown of Wired Magazine, who, as I said, did a lengthy profile of Sasha and Anne, and you can find a link to that article by going to our website, we're at theconnection.org. Graham Smith's our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.